everybody. Welcome to another episode of the Comic Source Podcast. I'm your host, Jace.
And this is Nick.
And this is a Top Cow Thursday episode. And we're going to be talking about a Top Cow book that came out yesterday, as this is released, May 9th. Namely, Port of Earth number 5. We've had Zach Kaplan on the show previously to talk about it. And I got to say, issue 5 really shifts the series kind of into high gear. A lot of action in this issue, much more so than there's been to this point. But we'll talk about it in a little bit because I don't know that's necessarily a good thing. I mean, it was an enjoyable issue. So anyway, we'll talk about that in a minute. We're also going to touch on Bonehead, from Top Cow, written by Brian Edward Hill. And it's from this glitchnetwork.com books that they're doing right now, along with Dissonance and God Complex. They're all very, very different books. And, you know, I went on Glitch Networks today to try to understand a little more, like, what is exactly is Glitch Networks? But it's in a foreign language. So I was like, I'm not really sure. I mean, I know, like, the God Complex characters, like, they have these really cool, like, high-end action figures. I'm thinking maybe Bonehead is the same. So I'm thinking maybe this is a Southeast Asia kind of website, kind of a social thing, and they have these really cool concepts, and they're making cool action figures for them, you know, for all three of the concepts, for Bonehead, for God Complex, and also for Dissonance. And they must have reached out to Top Cow and said, hey, we'd like to do some comics to flesh out the backstory of these worlds we've created. I think that's what it is. But I'm not 100%. I've only read the first issue of Dissonance, and it was good, but it's really dense. God Complex, also written by Paul Jenkins from Top Cow, really, really good, but also very dense. Bonehead, I don't know. Maybe it might be my favorite of the three. I don't know that I could. I kind of need to spend more time reading them in order to pick. But I will say Bonehead has the lowest barrier to entry. Like, it's pretty easy to pick up on. It's a whole heck of a lot of fun. The art is amazing. And, you know, it's Brian Edward Hill writing it. So, you know, you kind of expect it to be good. So those are the books to let you know. Those are the books we're going to be talking about for Top Cow Thursday as Nick turns off his text alert. But before we dive into the books, you know, Nick, as all you listeners have come to know, he's a huge champion of comic book movies, comic book TV shows, all things comics and other media, where I tend to be a little more of the curmudgeonly old man who just wants to read the stories as they're originally intended and see these characters as they're originally intended in the comic book form. And really, I shouldn't really say that. I love seeing these characters come to life. But if you would have told 12-year-old me that these characters that I love from comics, I was going to be able to see them on, you know, movie screens and TV screens, I would have been all in for it. But keep in mind what I said, like, I love to see these characters and love the idea of seeing these characters in live action. But they've got to be these characters. You can't change them so much fundamentally that they stop being the characters that I've read about and that I care about, right? Like, if you make Superman kill people, he stops being Superman, and then I don't want to watch that. If you fundamentally change stories but still use the title, I don't want to watch that. Like, if I go to see a movie called Civil War from Marvel, and you tell me it's based on the Civil War event from the comics, then I expect to read or to watch the Civil War event from the comics. I don't expect it to be a completely different story, right? I mean, otherwise, just call it something else. Zack Snyder, you want to make this really cool movie about an alien who's trying to decide if he fits into our world and trying to learn how to use his powers and have really cool special effects and completely over-the-top visuals? Hey, man, I'm all in. Just don't call it Superman. Because Superman doesn't kill. And Superman doesn't go to give Lois Lane a kiss when there's been massive destruction and people trapped in rubble and buildings. That's not Superman. So that's where I stand, Nick. So it's not that I hate the movies.
No, I know that.
But you've got to have some semblance of being true to the source material. And in some cases, I'm not saying in all cases, in some cases they stray too far.
As a screenwriting student, that was my bullshit major. I think it's more important to be true to the characters than to be true to the story necessarily. Like, okay. You can keep the spirit of the story, but I want to see the same character as the book, the novel, or the comic. Right.
I agree with that. It's more important to be true to the character. But I think
Marvel's nailed the character.
But what I don't understand is why can't, if the story is so different, why do you have to call it something from the comics? I don't understand that. Like it feels like sometimes they change stuff just for the sake of changing when it doesn't need to be changed. Like why is it Infinity Stones instead of Infinity Gems? Why did you need to make that change? That's just dumb. Why don't you keep it the same? And I think most people should probably be able to figure out, hey, Infinity Stones, Infinity Gems, the same thing, right? But why even change it so there's any question? Like, what if somebody went and saw Infinity War, right? They loved it. They're like, oh, I've got to go back and read that story. I'm going to go buy the Infinity Gauntlet trade paperback or whatever. And they open it up and they read it and they're like, wait, Infinity Gems? Wait, the colors don't match up with what was in the movie anymore. They've changed what color the space gem in and the time gem, like, or the space stone. Like, why make those? I don't understand. That's a stupid thing to do, in my opinion, because there's no reason for it. I mean, can you explain that to me?
Everything has to be simplified a bit. I know you hate that, but like, because you're releasing three Captain America movies over the course of 6 years rather than like 12 issues a year of Captain America. So a lot of the stories are kind of like, let's remove the elements that could have been covered in 3 years. Like
I get that.
You can't tie back to all these stories. There isn't 6 years of Captain America movies totally to tie back
that.
To.
I totally get that it can't be as complicated and, you know, movies.
And it's also like we don't own all these characters when it comes to like Infinity War or Civil War. Like there's no X-Men involved at all in Infinity War Silver Surfer or.
Right. No, I understand that. They don't have the rights to all the characters. And these movies, you know, some of them are up to 3 hours long now and you still can't fit the whole story from, you know, 6 issues of the Infinity Gauntlet comic plus the 2-issue prelude Thanos quest. You can't fit all that in a 2-hour movie. I totally get that. But I'm specifically asking about changing them from Infinity Gems to Infinity Stones and changing the colors. Why? Why does that need to be done? In my
opinion, the colors were all actually changed for a reason, because to fit the different items they were now attached to that they weren't attached to in the comic originally. Because a lot of items in the comic that are separate from Infinity Gems or Stones are Infinity Stones in this universe. That's the movie universe. Like, the Eye of Agamotto is the Time Stone.
What?
Eye of Agamotto is green, so they made the Time Stone green. Like, stuff like that. Or, like, the Space Stone is the Tesseract. So the Tesseract is blue, so the Space Stone has to be blue. Like...
Okay, so I think the Space Stone in the comics...
I think it is blue in the comics too,
yeah.
Isn't it?
Yeah, I think that was the same.
But in the Cosmic Cube and the Stone are separate in the comics. They're not the same item.
Right. But, so let's take... I mean, I don't even remember what the colors are. But let's just say for the sake of... So the Eye of Agamotto is green.
Yeah, the Soul Stone used to be green, right? I have my Infinity Gauntlet Bank, which is a...
And the Soul Stone,
old comic colors.
Yeah, and the Soul Stone was green, and the Time Stone was yellow.
One of the yellow ones. Yeah, I think it's one of the yellow ones.
Okay, so my question is this: if the Time Stone's yellow, first of all, the Time Gem's yellow in the comic, and the Eye of Agamotto is now the Time Gem, then just make the Eye of Agamotto yellow.
I know you haven't seen it, but that's like the twist at the end. Where he's been using the Eye of Agamotto, and at the end, one of the characters is like, one doesn't want to have an Infinity Stone hanging around their neck. Like, we should keep it in a safer place. I don't know. They have to simplify all of everyone's favorite beats into like, even with 18 movies, that's only like 40 hours. Like, and they're simplifying as much stuff as they can to fit in as many iconic moments, like the Winter Soldier storyline through Civil War.
And to me, that doesn't sound like simplifying. That seems like complicating. Because before, like in the regular story, the Infinity Gems are just out there in the universe to be found, right? They're not linked to any artifacts. So by linking them to the artifacts, now you're giving yourself extra hoops to jump through. You're actually making it more complicated. Just put them out there as gems that people found, just like the comics. Why can't you do that? And even if you decide, oh, it'll be cool if we link them up, because then it's like Easter eggs. Oh, all along the cosmic cube, or they didn't even call it a cosmic cube. They call it a tesseract. All along the tesseract was this powerful infinity gem. And so we're going to make it blue and blah, blah, blah. And the eye of Agamotto and the thing on Vision's forehead and all that stuff. Okay. Now you made it more complicated. You made everybody have to jump through hoops and you change the colors. Okay.
Well,
let me finish. Let's say I get on board with all that, right? You still didn't need to change the name from gems to stones. You didn't need to do that.
That is simply to make it more popular with 12-year-old boys. These days, a boy doesn't want to play with gems. He wants stones. I think that's purely the reason for that change is like, let's modernize it. So like little boys are like totally into all of it. That's really what I think that particular change comes down to.
You're not telling me they don't play a bunch of video games where they go and collect gems?
Gems, rupees, and Zelda.
I'm just saying, man. It just...
I know. That's the only change. That's the only reason that makes sense to me. Like as someone who's interned out there. I've never worked out there. But like... You know, the screenwriting class and knows all about adaptations. The only thing that makes sense is why you would change it. Like, there's no other reason to.
That's
unless it was just an accident and the first script said stone, but Kevin Feige's way more on top of it than that. So that's
where I come out. That's my soapbox that I stand on. And I know a lot of people are like, oh, you're an idiot. These movies are so great and blah, 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 blah. You know, read some comics. That's what I have to tell the people that think they know. I mean, I can't even tell you the number of times I've had somebody correct me, some, you know, Marvel Cinematic lover correct me on comic book lore. Because I don't know, it's not that. No, you're completely wrong. It's this. Like, no, if you actually read a comic book for once in your life, maybe you'd know.
Bucky fell off a train, not a rocket. That kind of stuff.
Yes, exactly. Exactly that kind of stuff.
You just have to think of it as a different multiverse. It's part of the multiverse.
You know, that's the only way I was able to actually get through Batman versus Superman. I was like, you know, I have to embrace this as a different version of reality and whatever. But I'm telling you this to explain why, despite the fact if you would have told 12-year-old me that these movies would be out there, that I haven't gone out of my way to go and see them. I will see them all. And... you know, listeners, I made the I don't know if you'd call it a vow, but I made the
promise.
Statement. I made the statement that I'd try to watch all the MCU movies before Avengers 4 comes out. And I think we determined it was like 12 or 13 movies, not realizing that in the meantime, while I'm trying to watch all these movies, even more are coming out.
Just to
Ant-Man and Captain Marvel. So I think it's like 14 or 15 movies I've got to watch. And then on top of that, we have decided in our infinite wisdom, both myself and others at LRM Online, that, hey, it would be great once Jace has seen all these movies to sit down in a room and watch them together with some guys from Los Fanboys and with Nick and myself. So I can sit there and pick and poke and they can make fun of me for being curmudgeonly old man about how could you do that? Oh, are you calling them Infinity Stones or they're Infinity Gems? So it'll be interesting to see how that goes, but I think it'll be fun regardless. Maybe especially if we involve some refreshments, shall we say?
Yes.
But specifically, the whole reason that I kind of brought this up was you heard a casting rumor. Was that today? Was the first time that you saw that?
Oh, which casting rumor?
The Batman casting rumor.
Oh, it's not a casting rumor. That was Dexter. That was Michael C. Hall saying he'd like to play Batman in an interview. And did like just someone did said the, something. What?
The person conducting the interview get up and slap him across the face?
Oh, the ones who probably asked him. I didn't actually. All I read is the quote from most of our interviews, to be quite honest.
So who did you know who he did the interview with?
No, it wasn't our website, but it was just one that circulates. You know, people are asking people that all the time. It's like, what superhero? When I had an interview with the Broken Lizard guys, I asked them which MCU characters they would want to play.
Wow.
Because Kevin Heffernan has actually been in Agent Carter.
That's
just a fun question. So, like, he was just him saying, yeah, I'd love to play Batman. I think it'd be cool.
But how original that everyone's asking this same question in interviews.
I don't know. I don't think anyone asked the Super Trooper guys that before because their answers were great. One said he wanted to play Captain America. The next guy said She-Hulk. And then they joked about how Heffernan, Farva and Super Trooper's daughter is into She-Hulk. And then they started getting into a little bickering fight about it. It was hilarious.
Okay, so I'm trying to find it right now.
Little hidden trick.
Let's see. He was talking to Yahoo.
Yahoo Movies or some shit.
Yeah, about his role voicing the Caped Crusader in the animated Justice League Gods and Monsters movie. But Batman in general, I like him as a superhero because he's not particularly endowed with superpowers. He's just smart and the suit. When asked if Batman was his favorite superhero, Hall confirmed, Batman, sure. I'm all for that when asked if he would play Batman.
See? Like, that happens all the time in interviews. It doesn't mean it's happening. It's just like, I was like, I didn't even know
where you got it from. You put it out on Twitter and I was, no. I mean, I'm sorry. Maybe people out there are Dexter fans and think he would be great, but I think that's...
Like I said, though, even better, I've always wanted him as Eddie Brock. He has the body type... everything to play in Eddie Brock.
Eddie Brock's a little more buff than Michael C. Hall, I think.
He can get pretty big.
I guess it depends on who's drawing him. Wait, Eddie Brock can get pretty big or Michael C. Hall can get pretty big?
Michael C. Hall can get pretty big. Not as big as Tom Hardy, but Michael C. Hall looks more like Eddie Brock than Tom Hardy.
That's true.
Or Norman, if he doesn't need to get as buff. I always thought he'd make a good MCU Norman Osborn. Yeah. Just like a slimy executive type.
I can see that. You know who would make a terrible Eddie Brock? And should never be anywhere allowed near the character in a million years.
Topher Grace?
Ding, 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 ding. You got it immediately.
Oh, shit.
Oh, my God.
He's my favorite villain, and they screwed him up so bad, it hurts. You know, bad adaptations hurt me, too.
That does bring up an interesting point. So you're not a big – I mean, you have to be – you love movies. You love films. So you have to be a fan of Tom Hardy. He's a great actor.
Yeah, I actually like his Bane quite a bit.
But you don't feel that he's right for Eddie Brock.
He's not wrong for Eddie Brock. There's much worse choices, I think. I've always thought Michael, for years, like before there was a Venom movie announced, I just thought Michael C. Hall has always struck me as like the perfect Eddie Brock.
I was kind of Arnold Schwarzenegger, you know. All right, maybe not.
Mr. Freeze Venom, that would be worse than Topher Gracing Venom.
Do you know what killed the dinosaurs?
The Ice Age.
So good.
There's a joke, real quick. There's a joke in Batman White Knight that we talked about for Comic Book of the Week where Mr. Freeze says, I'm all out of puns. And that's all it is. There aren't any bad puns in it, but it's a great Batman and Robin reference.
That's hilarious. I've heard very mixed response on the Venom trailer. I've heard some people say that the Venom, it just doesn't translate, and I can never understand how the guy could ever talk in the first place. Like in the Spider-Man, the animated series cartoon, how could the guy ever talk when his mouth is nothing but giant teeth and a tongue? Like it didn't make any, you know, you think he'd be like all, I can't understand what you're saying because I have this giant teeth and tongue in the way. You know what I mean?
That's not what I'm worried about the movie for. But going back to that, think about The Dark Knight. You've seen The Dark Knight, right? You haven't seen that one either?
No, The Dark Knight, the Joker one.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I've seen that, unfortunately.
Two-Face, where his face is like that. It's like, you couldn't form words if your cheek was burnt off. Like, It's just comic book.
Got to talk like back down in here. Yeah, I mean, I agree with you.
It would be coming out like blah, 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 blah.
Yeah, yeah, you're right. You're right. He'd need one of those pencil things, and he'd sound like a robot, like Stephen Hawking. I am Stephen Hawking. Yeah, I am Harvey Dent. Yeah, I mean, it's a minor quibble, but I've heard other people, like, I haven't seen the trailer. I've seen like maybe the little tiniest like half a second of it, where the like Venom was like. Costume was kind of like coming over his head, and it even that little bit I saw looked like bad. It looked like fan film.
It looks shitty on a computer. It looks great on the big screen. But I am Venom's, like I said, my favorite villain from either universe. You know, you know this part, right? Spider-Man's not in the movie at all, and his origins connected. Yeah, I don't see how you can do that.
I know Spider-Man's not in the movie, but his. The origin of Venom's not connected to Spider-Man?
No, not at all. He comes off of... They capture the symbiotes off of a crashed... whatever...
Spaceship?
Space shuttle. Yeah. Space shuttle. Like, so Spider-Man is never in contact with the suit. It can't have any of the spider powers.
Okay, so space shuttle. So it's set, like, back in the 90s? Or 80s?
No, it's set now. I don't know. Maybe it's not the space shuttle because they did retire that, but something crashes.
Because I've heard other people say, man, it's very 90s special effects. I was like, because I know like the Captain Marvel movie takes place in the 90s, right?
Yeah, but this isn't part of the Marvel Cinematic Universe.
Right, because Sony has the
direct. This is Sony's trying to make all the Marvel, the Spider-Man villain movies they can since that's what they own.
Right. And they already agreed to share the actual Spider-Man character. With Marvel, and they probably can get Marvel to sign off on putting Spider-Man in the Venom movie. I don't know. Honestly, I know it's not, Spider-Man should kind of be connected. I get that. And this is going to make me sound like such a hypocrite because I'm complaining about changing stuff earlier. And now I'm playing devil's advocate here. I mean, the symbiote is like this alien from outer space. Mm-hmm. So you're just removing you're just changing the way it got to Earth, really, instead of. Yeah. Piggybacking on Spider-Man.
You'd have to change part of its power set too, which they seem to do in the trailer.
Yeah, you have to change part of its power set.
Like it can't shoot webs anymore. But like in the trailer, you mostly see him use... Mostly it's him not even controlling it in the trailer. It's his tendrils just like shooting out and grabbing people and stuff. And it talks to him like in the current comic. So I like that a lot. Like it talks to him in his head.
I guess at the end of the day, for me, it doesn't really matter because I won't go see it anyway.
Yeah, and it won't be part of the MCU challenge. So
so I'm safe there. But I mean, I've heard a lot of people that they love Venom. I mean, he seemed to have had his ups and downs. I mean, when he burst on the scene, Spider-Man 300, Amazing Spider-Man 300, classic cover, Todd McFarlane book goes for like $600-800 now, he was like super popular. But then, you know, Marvel being Marvel, they brought him back right away. You know, Spider-Man defeated him. They bring him back all the time. And then they spun him out into Lethal Protector miniseries. And then he was in this series. He was in that series. Guest starring here and there. And he got oversaturated and people got tired of his shtick, right? And then, you know, eventually over the years, they give him breaks. And then Eddie Brock lost the symbiote. And then they had Venom gave birth to Carnage, and then there's, you know, now there's Maniac, and there's Anti-Venom, and there's a whole Spider-Venom universe out there, kind of. So I say all that to say this. I think what Marvel's actually trying to do, Marvel Comics, they're trying to kind of dial that back a little bit. And actually, just yesterday, on the 9th, with New Comic Day, we had a new Venom number one from Donny Cates and Ryan Segman, and you know, I didn't pick it up. Again, I'm not, you know, the biggest Venom fan in the world, but from what I understand, it's kind of going back to the roots of the character, what made him popular in the first place. Because here's the thing, like, I think he first appeared in 297, or two, no, 297 was the first McFarlane pencils. His first cameo was 298, but there was a mystery, like, you didn't know who he was. We didn't see him fully revealed until 300. But that's the thing. It's like Cates is taking this more horror take on the character and saying, let's less is more, basically. You know, Venom shouldn't be somebody where you understand what's going on in his head and you're privy to his thoughts. It's better if he's closed off and more menacing, you know, like we don't have insight into like Mike Myers from Halloween, you know, there's not thought bubbles. You don't understand what's going on in the guy's head. And that makes him more frightening, right? Because he doesn't even talk. I mean, you really have no idea what this guy's about, what his motivations are or whatever from him. You know, it's all from the backstory. So I think that's kind of what Cates and Stegman are trying to do. They're trying to make him a little more mysterious and thus feel a little more threatening and a little more kind of creepy and maybe raise, kind of take him back to his roots, like I said. Because, you know, he's been kind of an anti-hero for a while, which typically seems to happen with villains that get super popular because it's hard to keep us, you know, sales up on a title when somebody's doing like horrible stuff constantly. You've got to give them some kind of redeeming qualities. I mean, they did it with Poison Ivy. They did it with Harley Quinn. They've done it. They did it with Lex Luthor. They did it with Magneto. So they had previously done it with Venom, and now it seems like they're trying to take him back to, no, this is a bad dude. These are the bad things he does, and we don't necessarily know why. So it'll be interesting to hear your take on what the movie is, if it's more toward the recent Venom and, you know, in recent years as kind of an anti-hero, or if it's more, no, this is a bad dude. Do you have any plans on reading that Venom series?
Oh, the new one starting?
Yeah.
Yeah. I get Venom, and I get all the I've got all the Venom. I even get the Venom mini series and stuff. So I'll get them 3 months late, but I'll be reading everything Venom.
All right. Fair enough. Well, I suppose we should talk some Top Cow now since we're like 20 minutes in and we've been talking about movies and Venom and blah, blah, blah. So I just want to touch briefly on Port of Earth number 5. Give you the creative team, written by Zach Kaplan. The art is by Andrea Moody. The colors are by Vladimir Popov. And the letters are by Troy Pateri. So as I said, this is continuing the story that Zach's telling in Port of Earth. And if you're not familiar, Zach postulates, okay, what if aliens finally come to Earth? Like we finally have that first contact. They don't come to conquer. So they don't come in war. They don't come to gift us with, you know, benevolent advanced technology. They don't come in peace necessarily. But what they come with is a business deal. They say, hey, all these aliens that have had space travel for a while are expanding their reach, so to speak. And Earth is kind of on the edge of the galaxy and they're looking to go farther. And everybody has these engines that run on water that allow them to travel. And you guys have tons of water. In the oceans, because it doesn't have to be like desalinated or anything. It just need a little bit of water. It's not even a huge amount. And we just need to build a space station. We just need to build a space port, I should say, where the alien ships can come and dock, get a little cup full of water to refuel, and then be on their way. And in exchange, we will give you the technology of the water engine. So energy crisis over. So the powers that be decide this is a good idea. And we've had, as I said before, we've had Zach on the show. We've discussed this at length, whether or not it's a good idea or not. And it's easy to look at the world that Zach has created and say, oh, bad idea. Just instinctually for myself, being a kind of a glass half empty kind of guy. I have no doubt in my mind. They would not consult me. Right? The world leaders would not consult me before accepting this deal. They would accept it without really realizing the consequences of it. But if anybody were to ask me, I'd say, nah, man, this is not a good deal. There's too many unknowns. And that's exactly what happens in the book, right? The aliens are supposed to stay confined to the port. They don't. Innocent civilians are being killed. And the ESA, the Earth Security Agency, is formed to try to both protect the aliens and protect humans, right? Make sure the aliens stay in the port, do everything they can to preserve human life and to preserve alien life, which seems like kind of a dichotomous mission, really. And we see it's caused problems in the first volume. But the other thing about it is you got this technology, you got this water engine overnight, like snap your fingers, energy crisis over. The Earth's economy is nearly on collapse. I mean, just think about how many industries and industries that are dependent on those industries and industries that are then dependent on those industries all have to do with energy, right? Whether that be like electricity, you know, making cars, all that kind of stuff, all that machinery, like everything, car repair, you know, making tires, like just everything. And so without having to earn it at all, Earth just has this technology. And of course, the people that got to help out and make the decision, like the Halbertons and the Teslas and what have you, they're making money hand over fist. They're the only ones doing okay because they're the only ones that supposedly had the expertise, quote unquote, to manufacture these engines. So they're doing fine. But meanwhile, you know, average Joe Q public is not doing so great. So that's kind of the setting and the background for the world. And that's a very brief description of volume one. And the other thing that's interesting about the way Zach's telling the story, it's kind of a two-pronged approach. We have the director of the ESA sitting down for an in-depth interview with a reporter for a news agency. And that's where we get kind of all the high-minded ideas of what's going on. And then on the street level, we're actually following around some ESA agents as they attempt to track down an alien that has left the spaceport and seems to be up to no good. And so that's where issue 5 picks up. There's been a terrible tragedy at the end of issue 4, and the two agents that were right there on the front lines are now faced with the consequences and the repercussions of that tragedy. And they're kind of called back in to home base. One of them lost somebody really close to him and is told to kind of take some time off. The other one is assigned to help out with the security detail because there's actually a big meeting, a big get-together of all the leaders of the different alien races. They're supposed to be meeting to discuss something at the spaceport. And we find out that the alien that caused all the problems in the first place was assumed to have died in the explosion, actually didn't. And he's there to, for some reason, put the kibosh on this summit. And so, as I said, this issue is a lot of action and a lot of moving the story forward. There's a lot of plot development here. So you can pick up issue 5, and there's enough of a recap with what's going on in the first volume that you can hit the ground running. But that being said, I really encourage you to go and buy volume 1 because it's a really interesting idea, and I love the way Zach's exploring it. And I also would really encourage you to go back and listen to the episode that we had Zach on after or right when the volume 1 trade paperback was about to drop, where we kind of recapped the whole series and talked about if somebody were to have asked us, would we have made the deal? Was it a good deal for Earth? We get pretty deep. And again, you know, I've said a lot of times, my favorite comics are the ones that make me think. And this comic will definitely do that. So if you haven't picked it up yet, get down to your comic shop. Hopefully there's still some copies left, or you can ask them to order you a copy of Volume 5, and maybe you can check out the Volume 1 trade paperback as well. All right, next up we're going to talk about Bonehead. Let me give the creative team really quick. I mentioned earlier it's written by Brian Edward Hill. The art is by Roald Marcellius. That's RHOALDMARCELLIUS. I think that's correct. Roald Marcellius. And the colors are by Sakti Yuwono. Yuwono. So apologies if I messed up any of those names. And it says created by Machine 56. So that's, again, it's really interesting. Next time I see Matt, or Ryan Cady, but probably Matt. I'll probably wait and talk to Matt about it and be like, what's the deal with this this glitch networks thing? I want to understand it a little better. But basically, this is like parkour in the future. So there's gangs. They wear these what's called boneheads, or like these helmets that give them – they do a number of things. They feed them information, kind of like an Iron Man-style helmet, let them communicate, access different information, maps, and what have you. and they also protect their identity because they're kind of outlaws. It seems like the government and the corporations and the powers that be kind of are running a fascist state, and there seems to be kind of the ghetto or in some sci-fi stories, it would be like the ground level where everybody, where all the trash accumulates and all the people that can afford it live up in the high rises. And that place is called the Cobweb. And that's where you find poverty and disease and hunger and drug use. That's the other one that I was trying to think of.
And the city's called Chrome, right?
Yeah, the upper part of the city is called Chrome. Because it's, you know, again, gleaming and shining and super pretty and everything. So the actual story that Brian Edward Hill is telling is about one particular bonehead who doesn't talk, goes by the name or by the tag of 56. That's what he has on his helmet. And he seems to be like an incredible athlete. Like he can do parkour moves like better than anyone else. There's also this legendary bonehead from the past called Black Death, who had inspired a lot of the other previous gangs. Because the gangs are interesting. They're very much anti-establishment. And you can kind of think of them like gangs of today. But at the same time, there is some redeeming qualities to them. There's kind of a heroic, because they are pushing back against this kind of fascist government and kind of fighting for the little guy, so to speak. But that's not to say that they're not thieves and criminals and they're not out for themselves. So it's an interesting dichotomy there. But what we find is that there's a kind of a scientist tech guy called Aleph, and he found this young boy, hooked him up with – who was like paralyzed, couldn't move. We don't know exactly what that was all about, but gave him this bonehead that he created apparently that has some kind of nanite technology in it, and it allows 56 to – now move and have these abilities far beyond like a normal parkour gang member. But he can't talk. He communicates through like these little images, these little like emojis. And it's not clear if they just like pop up as little holograms or whatever. But it seems like he's kind of learning. So that's kind of the stage that's set. The other character that I'll mention is Black Death himself is actually now a gladiator. So that would be like the police force. And he's Aleph's brother. And he used to be, you know, this infamous bonehead, Black Death. And then he, for some reason, we don't know why, decided to hang up his bonehead as Black Death and try to work within the system to make change. So those are kind of the characters that we see. And I'm not sure how many issues it's supposed to be. I thought it was only supposed to be four. But, you know, I've read 1 through 3. And I can't see how this all gets wrapped up in one more issue. And maybe it doesn't. Maybe it's, you know, there's going to be four and then they'll take a break and then there'll be another arc if the sales are good enough. But yeah, that's kind of the overall story. And I'm going to let Nick give us his take on it. And then I'll talk about like what I actually thought of the series.
Yeah, well, I actually enjoyed it quite. I didn't realize this was based off a toy release, more or less?
Yeah, I think so. Again, I'm not 100% sure what the Glitch Network is, but I know that's what the God Complex ones are based on. They're like, there was a series of like either statues or action figures that were like fashion / sci-fi. And this idea that this company came up with this idea and created the statues and kind of had a backstory, but it wasn't like really fleshed out. And so I think they did the same thing with the bonehead. I think that's the same kind of thing. They just came up with the concept of the world and the look of the characters, but they hadn't told any. So then they reached out to Top Cow and like, hey, flesh this out for us, you know, kind of like, think of it like G.I. Joe, right? Like Hasbro,
yeah.
When they brought G.I. Joe back or when Hasbro did Transformers, you know, the people at Hasbro came up with the basic idea and the characters and the way they looked. And they reached out to Marvel and said, okay, now tell stories and sell comics so kids will want to buy the action figures.
And then you said Machine 56 appeared somewhere else or it just appears on this title as far as creator?
Yeah, I know. I mean, I've never
– that's the character's name is 56.
That's the character's name, 56. I've never seen that creator's name ever before. Machine 56, never.
That's what I was going to ask, if you thought it was a real creator or just a reference to the character being created by Machine 56.
Well, it might be. My thought is it's maybe it's the like the internet identity of somebody that works over there at Glitch Networks. But I have no way of actually knowing that.
Interesting. Well, I really like the book a lot. I wasn't entirely clear what the boneheads could or could not do, or what they were or were not displaying at sometimes. I wasn't sure if it was like a full-on Oasis type experience like Ready Player One, or if it was more of just a heads-up display like Iron Man.
Yeah, I think it's more,
because it seems to give him. What were you saying?
I said I think it's more of a HUD. It's more of a heads-up display is my take on it.
Because that seems to give them extraordinary jumping abilities and stuff too. Is that just exaggeration, you think?
I think that's partially exaggeration. But remember, 56 has the nanites.
That's true.
So that's probably enhancing his. You know, he's probably already like top 1% of parkour athlete. You know, bonehead already. And then he's got the nanites that, you know, boosts him up even more, would be my guess.
Well, I really, one of the favorite things about this book is the way Ryan Edward Hill shows information about a character. Like when it's showing, what is this? One of the gladiators, Gladiator 32 for the first time. It like gives a listing of his like abilities or like weapons, like you're playing a video game. And I continue to notice that throughout the book, that a lot of characters are introduced like it's a video game level where it's like Sector 30, through the urban residential area, Sector 30, threat level high, like blah, blah, blah. Or Ravager is low level, just digital service crew, status minions. Like that kind of thing struck me as a video game thing. And then they actually have the video game panel in issue 3, where it's obviously a video game reference. So, first of all, it was just a cool sci-fi technique, but then I began to realize it was really cool, kind of almost making it more of a video game type book with some relations to that. In addition to, there's a little bit of anime in here, but I don't mind that at all. And a few other things. What else did I kind of write down? I don't know. It also kind of has a little bit of a Batman feel, honestly, with Black Death stepping off and thinking about coming back when things are getting worse. And
we know Brian Hill's a big Batman fan.
Oh yeah, we know exactly. That's one of the reasons I thought of it. And then just, overall, I don't know, it almost is like a combination of Coruscant from Star Wars and like a Mad Max type future where like ground level is kind of like Mad Max with these games with gangs with nicknames like Pumpkin Juice and I have alliance to Tyrant the King and stuff like that. Whereas like, yeah, on the surface, it's almost, it's almost more like Coruscant or Cloud City or something. It's a fun book. I really like this, the way that it kind of slowly unfurls the sci-fi elements. So you don't know what's going on. And almost like Westworld or something, it starts peeling away the parts where you're like, oh, that's how the world's working. And you're slowly seeing how different people fit together. And even the tech kind of works. And that was my favorite part about it. Is like first issue, you're like, second issue, you're like, oh, I get a little bit more. And it just keeps pulling back and you see the bigger picture.
Yeah, so. The other thing about the book, my take on it is, you look at God Complex, or you look at Dissonance, you know, two other Glitch properties. Super dense. Again, the barrier for entry seems higher. It seems like you have to kind of invest more to understand. Whereas Brian has taken a property that could very well have been just as dense, and he's made it, I feel, more accessible and a lot of fun. He's just throwing you in the middle of the story and going, yeah, you could spend time thinking about this and trying to figure it out, but how about if you just come on this really fun adventure ride with me and, we'll figure out the details a little later. Because you don't need to understand exactly what the government is like. You don't need to understand exactly what the chrome part of the city is like. You don't need to understand exactly what the cobweb city is like. You just need a sense of all that, because really, And this goes back to what we were talking about with the movies earlier. Really, what sells it is the characters. The character of Bonehead, or the character of 56, is mysterious and interesting and compelling, and you want to know more. A-Lift, the scientist, and the relationship with his brother, who used to be, you know, Black Death. Why did he quit? Why did he do it in the first place? Why is A-Lift, you know, why is he fighting against the powers that be? How does that relationship work with his brother? I mean, his brother, the Gladiator, straight up tells him, what you're doing is illegal. I could arrest you. You're gonna, you know, get yourself arrested. You're gonna get this 56 kid killed. Like, what the heck are you doing? But then in issue 3, it kind of flips and he's like, maybe this is a better way. Maybe it is time for Black Death to come back. I mean, there's so much there. It's all, the story is all driven by character, which is the best kind of story. And it's the ones that are compelling and make you want to pick them up and read them, rather than kind of struggle to ask questions and figure out exactly what the world is and what all the details are. That'll come with time. And I really hope we get at least another 4 issues. I think it's really, the world is rich enough to really support that. And part of the reason I wanted to talk about this on the podcast this week is because it has been, I think, flying under a lot of people's radar. I mean, I'm a huge Top Cow fan, and I didn't even remember hearing about this until issue 2 came out. I'm not sure how that happened. I mean, usually I get like preview copies of everything. So I don't know if I just missed it somehow, or I was like, wait, what's this Bonehead, Brian Edward Hill? Wait, it's from Top Cow. Like, how did I? And yeah, so then I dove in and I was like, wow, this is really, really good. And then when I read issue 3, I mean, issue 3 really kicks it into overdrive. And you're just like, yeah, okay. Not sure how this is all going to get wrapped up in one more issue, but I will definitely be picking it up to find out. And again, I'm not really familiar with the other creators, like the Roald Marcellius. But man, his art is spectacular. It's so you don't really like anime, and I don't think it has an anime feel, but it does have an animated feel. It does have like
I was looking at it, I'm like, I was wondering if you'd ask me about that, because yeah, it does. What book were we
Betrothed?
This one kind of has that kind of look, but it not in a way that. Like, I actually really enjoyed the art and was going to compliment, especially there's a panel where he's like sliding across the city. And again, like that Batman issue I'm talking about, you like see like 4 or 5 of them going across the panel. So yeah, I really like the art a lot too. Describing it as like an animated series. It's very solid colors and stuff. So that might be
really primary colors.
Yeah.
What is it? What is a little bit anime though? Is like the hairdos, you know, the big giant mutton chops or the weird, just the weird, like, what's his, the guy that's his boss? I don't know.
Oh, I've written down. Toshiro?
Yeah, Toshiro. Yeah. So he's like, I guess the captain of the gladiators, like think of him as a captain in the you know, police force. Yeah, Toshiro Nobata.
Chief Gladiator 13.
Yeah, Chief Gladiator 13. And he's got the weirdest. His goatee looks like Goku's hair. Kinda. It like flares out on the side. And then you see a little bit of his cheeks. And then his giant like mutton chop sideburns start. But the Goku hair doesn't like meet together. It's not like a mustache on his upper lip. And his chin is bare too. It's just you have to see it for yourself, man. He's got the Goku goatee. Yeah. And
buy the book for that alone.
Right, exactly. And then what's the brother, what's the Gladiator 32? What's the brother's name?
I have that written down also. It's Hideki? Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce any of the names.
Hideki, I think is how you say
Hideki.
It.
Hideki.
Yeah.
Yeah, that actually looks closer to what it should be too.
Yeah, Hideki Cray, Gladiator 32. So he's got some giant mutton chops too. And so those things specifically, it reminds me a little bit of and kind of the angularness of the face. Reminds me a lot of Battle of the Planets or G-Force as I knew it when I was growing up, that cartoon. But it's not it's not like traditional manga. It's not, they don't have like giant eyes. Mm. There's not like the stylized, you know, emotion when they, you know, trying to show surprise and you get the big O mouth and the eyes get really big. So it very much stays kind of a consistent style. And so, yeah, this is art I really enjoyed. I think the storytelling from panel to panel is really well done. And to your point about a couple of the panels where we see movement like Mikhail Yanin does, I really enjoyed those. But if I have any nitpick, and he does Roald does do it sometimes where he has characters go out of panels, like they're – you know, their leg might hang down to the panel below or whatever. But for the most part, his panel layouts, you know, the way the panels are arranged on the page, it's a lot of rectangles and a lot of squares. There's, for the most part, there's not a lot of non-traditional panel layouts. And early on in issue one with that cool sequence with 56, I was expecting a little more dynamic panel layout. So it's a small, very small nitpick. And I'm sure if Roald is somebody who's new to comics, it may be something that he gets more comfortable with as he goes along, switching it up. But when you're new, you know, you don't want to experiment too much because you want to make sure you do a good job. So, yeah, I think it's a really, really great series. Bonehead, just based on the fact that I haven't heard a lot about it, I think that the issues are probably relatively easy to find. Or if your comic shop hasn't heard of it, and they haven't been ordering it, they should be able to order it for you, because I doubt any of these issues have sold out. So Diamond probably still has copies available. So yeah, I mean, it's Brian Edward Hill. It's a heck of a lot of fun. It's, you know, when I saw issue two came out, and I'm like, wait, there's a Brian Edward Hill book called Bonehead? What the heck's this about? I haven't heard of this. And then I read the solicit. I'm like, wait, futuristic parkour gangs? Yeah, I mean, right there I was in. Those three words. Futuristic parkour gangs. I'm like, yep, Brian Edward Hill's writing this. I'm in. So, and it didn't let me down. So kudos to Brian once again. Anything else you want to add about Bonehead? I know you haven't read any of Portaverse, so we'll have to remedy that in the future.
No, I enjoyed the universe and kind of the different ideas they introduced, including the way that 56 talks with the symbols and stuff. It was just a lot of cool little elements to it.
Yeah, I agree. I agree 100%. So go and check it out, everybody. And once again, Nick and I want to thank you all for listening. Don't forget, you can go to lrmonline.com for all past episodes of the podcast. Twitter.com/TheComicSource is where we can be found on Twitter. Do a search for The Comic Source on Facebook and Instagram to follow us on those social platforms. All three places are a great spot to find out when we release new episodes and follow along with our convention coverage. So we want to thank you all for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.